Jesus, the light of the world. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Tired of petty bickering among his own religious crowd, Jesus leaves Judea to head home. But, John tells us, he had to go through Samaria. Why had to go, I wonder? Samaria not only was out of his way, it was also rough terrain compared to the coastal routes to the east and the Jordan Valley coast, coastway to the west, Jordan Valley to the west. As Raymond M. Brown notes, elsewhere in the gospel, the expression of necessity means that God's will or plan is involved. He had to go through Samaria. God was sending the light that enlightens all people to a land and a people at enmity with his people. When he arrives in the land, Jesus is tired and sitting alone by Jacob's well. According to Amy Jo Levine, John is luring us into a type of story, a story in which boy meets girl at the well. Here's how it comes. A future bridegroom journeys to a foreign land where he encounters a young woman at a well. One of them draws water. The girl runs home to bring news to the stranger. The stranger is invited to a meal. The betrothal is agreed to by both. Think Isaac meeting Rebecca, Jacob meeting Rachel, Moses meeting, anybody know the name of Moses' wife? Sapphira. In the case of the Samaritan woman, all this happens, but she runs by herself to tell the whole village, and they invite Jesus, the whole village invites Jesus to abide with them. Because more than a few Samaritans were a part of John's community, perhaps this is John's founding story of that unlikely covenant between the bridegroom, John the Baptist titled for Jesus a few verses ago, and an unlikely bride. Or not. Enter the bride. Two things we know for sure about her. We know she is a woman. Johannine scholar Jamie Clark Soles reminds us that she lives in a world where men have almost all the power and women next to none. Physical power, financial power, religious power, political power. All she knows is that she's alone, unprotected with a foreign man who is breaking established social boundaries. She is on guard. No doubt that is true. And yet at the same time, the lens through which she sees as a woman is a lens of extreme vulnerability. We also know that she is a Samaritan. Samaritans came into being when, in the late 8th century, Assyria invaded Israel, taking the wealthy and wise Jews into exile while leaving the poor and unskilled. Foreigners were then sent to Israel by the king of Assyria so that they might dilute the Jewish population by intermarrying, thereby preventing insurrection. Do you see where this is going? So Jewish women were bedded by the people of Babylon who worshipped Succoth-Benoth, the people of Cuth who worshipped Nergal, the people of Hamath, who worshipped Ashima, the Avites, who worshipped Nibhaz and Tarkat, as well as the Sepharites, who sacrificed their children to the gods of Sepharvaim. As the writer of 2 Kings put it, so they worshipped the Lord, but also served their other gods. Was Jesus addressing her sex life with his prophetic insight? Or was he acknowledging her syncretism, acknowledging the amalgam of gods she worshipped? The Samaritan woman's beliefs are another lens through which she sees Jesus. But what does John want us to see of Jesus through her eyes? Here is my wild guess. I think Jesus had to go through Samaria. I think God sent Jesus to Samaria because the world God so loved, the world God loved by sending his Son, will not be bounded by religion. He had to go through Samaria because without this conversation, we would see him as belonging to us, his light shining alone on us, his truth known only to us. Even though lines will harden and boundaries be drawn in the next few centuries of Christian doctrine, John's gospel glows through the confines of religion in ways that never cease to blow my mind. To wit, he writes in the beginning that what came into being with the Word was life, and the life was the light of all people. I take that to mean that from the beginning, the light of God's Word has not been limited to one place or one time or one people or one religion. As for the end, where this is all going, the Good Shepherd says later in John's Gospel, "I have sheep that do not belong to this fold. I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice, so that there will be one flock, one shepherd." And in between, you know that oft-quoted verse used to seal our possession of him? "No one comes to the Father but by me." If you're not a Christian, you're going to hell. Well, if you read the context, if you read that sentence and keep reading, it unravels. Because Jesus says to Philip in so many words, "If you don't believe She says the church can and should be the place that helps the world glimpse mutuality, reciprocity, and regard. Do we even remember what those qualities look like? So this conversation happens in the first place between two people who all are vulnerable in their own ways. A first century woman alone at a well in the blazing sun, and a man by himself in a foreign, even hostile territory, who is also God's son destined for the gallows. Sometimes you can choose to be vulnerable. Sometimes the circumstances of your life make you vulnerable. Sometimes vulnerability is your destiny. In response, you can spend all your life denying it, or you can see the vulnerability in the threatening other that makes him, makes her, no less human than you are. So it was with Jesus and the Samaritan woman. That is where truthful conversations must start, Lewis says, from a place of reciprocal vulnerability, from a space that recognizes that each party risks knowing and being known. In the second place, questions that communicate curiosity, interest in the other, a longing for understanding, are critical to conversations across boundaries. The tagline for the Interfaith Center of Greater Philadelphia is "Dare to Understand." I love that tagline. This theologically wired woman is full of questions for Jesus. She's curious about who he is. Somehow they meet in that vulnerability and then begin to really talk. "How is it that you are even talking to me?" she asks. "Where do you get that water? Are you greater than our ancestor Jacob?" In the second hour, we will have the privilege of participating in a conversation with Imam Abdur Razak Miller. And he will say to you, "Just call me Richard, it's easier." And we will be talking with him about how he sees Jesus as a Muslim. I suspect most of us know very little about Islam. So the questions we ask, the interest we take in Imam Miller's faith, our longing to understand, will be the key. And given that he used to be a Presbyterian, he's a few steps ahead in understanding us. Third, conversations that lead to understanding take time. Time. And along the way, there are bound to be misunderstandings. When we cannot understand, we can do as Nicodemus did and shut down. Stop asking. Stop talking. Disappear. But the Samaritan woman perseveres, as does Jesus. She's like Jacob wrestling for a blessing and a name. At the end of the conversation, unlike Jacob at the Jabbok, she receives a name. Jesus said to her, as God said to Moses at the burning bush, "I am. Ergo am me." Only place Jesus acknowledges that he is the Messiah with a Samaritan woman. I can tell you why later, there's no time. Could it also be in the midst of that same conversation and reflected through the eyes of the Samaritan woman that Jesus came to understand the length and depth and height and breadth of the love that he was in a way that he could not have without her? Well, finally, to be engaged in a conversation such as this requires both parties to expect that they will be surprised and changed. Otherwise, neither party is having to do with God. It is within the realm of possibility that Jesus was surprised by the woman's astonished response to him, leaving her water jar and running to tell the whole city. Given her testimony to her neighbors, we know she was surprised by Jesus. we ought to behave toward one another as though we were stuck with each other eternally. Because in his love,